Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects, and welcome back. We've been away for a couple of weeks, traveling. We attended the Grand Lodge of Cuba, which was a very, very interesting experience in dignity and fraternity. I have a proposition to today that I want to speak with you about. Hope you don't mind. You know, we haven't being able to pull up a chair and sit down with each other for a while. So, of course, a lot has happened. The proposition is about perspective. Where I am, and I don't think it's an isolated event, so we spend a great deal of energy and time looking at I don't know whether it's rehabilitation or correction or just something that's happened organic and it managed to take us off the off the scent, so to speak. So I've been thinking about this. Like, what is it that we spend a lot of time doing? And I think what we spend a lot of time, I don't know if it's, you know, it's mending or revival. I think that there's a distraction, at least where I am in the fabric of masonry. There's a great deal of distraction and almost an all-encompassing focus on fixing or working with men that really aren't invested. And now, if we put this to them, this is where I need your assistance. If I put this to them, they would say, "Well, we're quite ample, and we have the apron to prove it." But there's a I don't know if it's a yes. There's in some corners I'm talking about sloth and a lack of conviction. The idea that I'm wrestling with is whether a man, a mason, takes the vows seriously, takes the morality serious enough to learn them. Now, learning them, reading them, going through ritual isn't enough for some. Some of us, you know, you take it, it's startling, and you take it seriously the first time. It's like, you know, when you're drowning and somebody reaches through the water to grab you by the hand and pull you up. It's like, that's the best moment in life. This is something more complex. You see the difficulty here already. The struggle is, instead of talking about refinement of thought and exchange of ideas and information, the focus of a great deal of energy, an inordinate proportion of energy, is directed at ways to convince or seduce these men back into masonry. And I just, for the life of me, I the fact that it goes on decade after decade, the fellows haven't been asked if they are interested in being rehabilitated. They're perfectly happy, it seems. And they're immune to the efforts, it goes so far as there are suggestions made that they ought to already understand, and we have something that's called protocol and etiquette. So it's like, if you can't figure it out, here's a way of, here's a reference guide about, certain courtesies and procedures. It gets a little murky because these things are prone to change, and we don't have it in a handy, way of retrieving this information. It's laborious, and that's considered, well, that's quite important. That's quite dutiful. If you want the information, you go and look for it. But these are guys that don't want necessarily feel that there's a need for any of it. So I am. That to me amounts to ineffectiveness, and I thought it's not. I want to suggest that we change the focus from the person to the what and the when. I think that we have done ourselves a disservice, both the fellows that have somehow been sponsored and got through the whole process and lose interest very, very quickly. Now, I can't, I can enroll you in a program. I can take your fees. I can offer you a qualified professor and a curriculum that fits your learning requirements. But after that, I cannot twist your arm to study. I cannot twist your arm to think about, to motivate, to think about how you will, that displaced benefit. That it is hard work, but the payoff comes when you are skilled and you're able to deliver and take on that responsibility in life. And if you can think of it, instead of complaining or saying, well, I'm going to cut the classes because, and you've heard all of these glib comments, and I'm a bit embarrassed, but not embarrassed. I'm a bit, it angers me in a way, which it shouldn't. These are people in this crowd that will mock education. Oh, higher education is ridiculous. Everything should be about profit. Well, look around. That thinking has been heard by government and politicians. We don't rely on them for a lot of insight. And it's affected the Board of Governors of a lot of universities. If a course isn't profitable, then it's cut. That's, you realize what this does in the grand scope of things. Back, was it 2008, we had a big financial collapse. It happened around the world, and it was people gambling with your money, taking wild, wild risks in the hopes of making the big score. This was very boyish. and it cost the world. The world came to its knees financially. Although we had systems to blur that line and distract us, but it did. Trillions and trillions of dollars. An analysis was done. Like, what happened here? I mean, there was checks and balances. We have all kinds of algorithms. This ought not to have happened. However, there was a realization that some of the major business schools, premier business schools, had removed ethics and philosophy from their curriculum. So they were turning out graduates that didn't have an ethical backstop. And of course, if you're operating without ethical accountability or without a moral fabric, greed, competition, and deception, it's a Machiavellian world, isn't it? And they've all digested the ways to be deceitful and feel good about it, validate yourself. So we know that ethics is important in general, but on a day-by-day basis, there are a lot of people in our lodges that don't. They don't either don't care or don't know. They either won't do the work or they can't do the work. We don't know. The question you might ask is, what are they doing? What are you doing with your system, allowing these people access to masonry? That's a very, very good question. But here, I need a better solution than that. That's kind of a simplification because it's been said and thought through before over and over. So the question is, what in the world is going on? What else can we do? What other options? And I think it's right in front of us, like most things. Isn't it possible that instead of trying to cajole the people that are chewing gum at the back of the classroom and aren't taking their entrance into the class seriously? You know, all right, I've enrolled in physics class. Oh, I hate physics. You know, I'm going to bring that kind of dredge into the room and not only show my own meagerness, but I want to impose that on anybody within earshot. And the environment of university, it's your maturity on the line. If you don't choose to do it, you pay your money and leave. You know, but you're not going to get the credentials. Certainly not. You have to earn it. That's merit. Eternal order, I'd like to think that we can do that. Of course, we're free to do that. We're also free to step back and look more carefully at the caliber of people coming that we're allowing in. And not to argue the fine points. There are all kinds of reasons. We are masterful at rationalizing. We are masterful, and I think we can admit that too. But I think there's something that is more provocative in terms of what to do. I take you into the guild, and I am the master, and I have a number of apprentices, and they are bonded to me for what will we say 7 years. And I am, and the deal is, you want to be here because we've got a lineup of young men, very willing to take your place if you're not up to snuff. You show up earlier than early, and you work later than late, and you apply yourself, and you start off with the simple stuff. And if you have artistry, that will come to the surface. We'll make sure of that. But we have stopped. There's apprentices that have lost interest, and so within our brotherhood, we seem to have hit pause. That our conversation is going to be limited that our focus is going to be directed toward the majority that aren't engaging. And understand that, that the priority is our lodges are emptying. The caliber of work is suspect at best. The sense of meaning, if you scratch the surface, is very, very little embrace, other than surface level understanding. And we've been for a long time expected to sit back and say, yeah, that's fine, that's just the way it is. However, I draw your attention to the fact that we have had and do have artists, and we do have men of intelligence. And I think this is one of the qualifiers that we need to be able to look at very frankly. It's not the profession or the trade of the man. It's the intelligence. I'm not going to necessarily admit somebody to my lodge because he has a certain profession, but I will look at them, assuming that if you are in some professions, you have a proven ability to research and work and focus. That does not mean you have the qualities of a good man that we need as an entered apprentice. We need to have that sense of some proof of the character before they come in the door. Not somebody that's going to convince me that they are upstanding, but proof that they are, that I can see objectively, evidence. Now, that said, I have thought that I want to work with the I'll carry. I've got such a big operation that I can carry a bit of dead wood, or people that are never going to, they're going to plateau at a very early level of training. Okay, but our operation is growing and it's so big that they will have a place. Then I'm never going to put them in charge of design, but they do have a place, and they may be quite happy with that, or if they are self-important, they may think that they should be treated with a greater respect without doing the work. We've seen that, whether that's on the shop floor or in the lab. We've all seen that kind of thing, we know, or the courtroom. So I think that we would be wise to consider inspiring instead of cajoling and praising meagerness. I think it would be wise to set our talented entered apprentices and fellow crafts to the task of creation, and and continue on those discussions as if the other guys were quite satisfied, but had to deal with their own responsibility, that their growth was not our responsibility. I know, heretical. I know you can see, I can smell the sulfur from and the lightning strikes all around me for saying that. But bear with me. I'm not an evil, totally evil person here. That we set you to work being creative. Now, what happens when you're creative and you're artistic and you have a means of expression? Well, when we look around, we might see you being very intense and not wanting to be distracted. My lovely friend Bill is like that. When he starts a painting, he has to be so focused. And then when he stops, he's this most lovable, engaging kind of character. But the talent requires, just demands that of him. And think of the results. If this group, my inner group, my group of that you got to by merit, work together, I would have presumed that they would be they would be inspiring and encouraging each other just by merit alone. And the fellows that are on the outside with their nose pressed up against the glass looking in are outside the glass, knowing full well while they're out there. You know, when you, and it doesn't have to be priggish, it don't have to be, self-absorbed about it. When you reach this point, come and talk to me. When you feel you've reached this point, come and talk to me. And what we want is that man's reasoning about himself to balance with mine. Don't we? To balance with mine. Then we have some truth going on, don't we? Then we have self-evaluation, self-awareness beginning. Because the next question I'll ask is, you're at this point, what do you need to work on next? You start. That's taking responsibility for yourself. Now, and I'm in the background, I know that men mature at different stages for different reasons. Yes, I know all of that. But that's not the point I'm making here. The point I'm making is that we have the capacity to think and operate and create and explore. We have a history that inspires and has done so for well beyond 300 years. And we know masonry was going on. We know the Gaius manuscripts. We know the earlier references to masonry in Scottish style. And we know these things. And the more we investigate, the more we discover and we add. And it changes our, rewrites history. We drew our attention to the talent. We focused our attention to the talent. If you want to be part of that in-group, you want to be part of that enthusiasm, here's some tools. Learn them. It's like I'm creating a symphony, and I want the big one, 126. And today I'm saying all you have to do is line up and be enthusiastic, and you can have a seat. I need 20 strings. I need 40 in the horn section. You can tell, and maybe I'm doing Wagner. Anyway, but you can practice. We'll only practice once just to get together, have a drink. If you don't want to play the part, follow the score that the conductor has selected or that I have selected this production, you don't have to. Oh, and if you want to work to your own beat, not the conductor's, you go right ahead. You know, it's a free world, isn't it? You're a free Mason. You just go right ahead. And that's where I'm living. That's the masonry that I see. Only the publication, the advertising is, come, this is a symphony. We're doing Ophelia. It's going to be wonderful. A full orchestra. Here's that we have a guest conductor. And it will be playing at the most famous playhouse in the nation. That's what we're doing. And my advertising is going to also tell you, in 1867, we put on these productions, and the audience went, oh, it was just rapture. And we are, you know, we're tempting the fates. We're going to be backing up the National Ballet. They're going to do the Nutcracker. Christmas is coming up, of course. We need that Russian passion, you know, that cultural stimulation and sharing the myths and stories. That's the orchestra. Now, you're expecting me to think that is going to last? Maybe I am being, I don't think I'm being too harsh. I think what I'm doing is putting words, trying to describe something that's been going on for an awful long time. And I would rather that we pull the plug on that, and turn to the small group who are willing to show up to rehearse, to treat their, inject, to be part of the artistry of masonry, and to have that symbiotic joy, that happiness of doing that as a group, where we're not looking to change anybody's thinking. We're not looking to help anybody change their character. Not at all. It's simply some people like doing this and some people don't. And if you like doing it, this is the place for you. This is the Medici. We're inviting a powerful and ruthless family, but we are also able to support the arts. And we're inviting all the greatest artists to come to our studio where you'll be trained and you will train. And that's the nature of the beast. And do I feel bad about the human condition out there? No. No. What in the world? No. The world is what it is. And is there situations, are there circumstances that need to be improved? Well, of course. And are there vulnerable people that need our assistance? Well, where I am, we throw out corporate checks and we even brag about it. We're not looking at the vulnerable. Around me, the vulnerable would be people going to sleep hungry, people that are the working poor, unable to feed the children as they go off to school. The little ones, you can imagine this is future generations. We can tolerate all of that. And women's shelters, it's epidemic. And we can tolerate that and make political excuses. Now, if I think about my vows, I think that's vulnerability. That's innocence. That's helping innocence. It's safer to throw a check at corporate charity. I'm not saying that they don't serve some purpose. I'm saying that's not what I was. On bended knee, that was not the image that I was taught. So, and does it matter in my community? But I don't get to wave a flag. Nobody's going to come out of a food bank and necessarily, and I'm not expecting them to shake my hand for making sure or putting pressure on some of these people making big decisions to help ensure that everybody has enough to eat. We don't do that. We don't do that in the profane world. Well, if the profane world is doing it and in masonry, we're distracted and making, you know, continuously rationalizing. We seem to have missed the point a little bit. You see where I'm going. Let me stop here just for a second, a little pause with a bit of music, and we'll come back. I think it's a good show today. The poetry, you're just going to love the poem. Wilfred Owen, he's just a brilliant World War I poet. Here. Amazing. Just amazing. Beautiful music. Beautiful. When you think those thoughts, here's a short commentary. So many options. Some come from people who want to control. Some believe we ought to be influenced by their designs. But they know what should occupy our attention more than us. We suffer fatigue from relentless advertising. Broken men will want to escape it. common sense tells us when we don't know what to do, do nothing. Set to your work with focus, but keep your eyes and ears open. This is history repeating itself. Kiss. That's background noise. I'm pretty sure if that's what's on our minds, that we aren't working hard enough. And if we're not working hard enough, either we aren't enjoying what we're doing, or there's something else that is taking our attention, grabbing our attention. But to add to it, life is serious and life is hard enough. But to add to it by burdening ourselves with the notions that with it's just a general unhappiness about what we're doing. That's not fair to the person saying it. It's certainly not fair to the people around that have to listen to it. But what to do? What's the solution? Perhaps focus, wouldn't you say? What would you Zen masters say? Would you talk to us about different types of meditations and a way of refreshing your thinking? Yes, it works. Something to think about. Poetry. We lean in to help us expand our understanding, our senses, to remind us that there are different ways of thinking about life around us and the occasions, the events that happen to us, the people that we meet. Poetry has been a stimulant for a great long time, but the government of the day thought that boys like me would never amount to anything, and of course, it would be a waste of time trying to teach them poetry. Except unless it was a way of disciplining, a way of triggering more discipline, and then that was quite fine. I want to share with you the work of a fellow that I am completely so pleased that I finally discovered the work of Wilfred Owen. And I'll tell you, I don't mind taking a moment to tell you a little bit about this very, very interesting man. I'm one of the most fortunate men that I've ever met. I was born after a war. I've never been called to service. I've been busy with getting on with contributing to the economy and family and things like that, paying your fair share and staying out of trouble, obeying the laws of the land and trying to be a better Mason. But I've had encounters with soldiers, many encounters, intimate encounters with your friends and brothers and sisters and fathers and grandfathers. And I'm the one that people would talk to candidly, more candidly than they would when they needed to unburden themselves. And they did not want to risk you, members of the family. I was that person. And I paid attention, of course, as you can imagine. And I never heard a soldier talking about wanting to be, talk about praising war. That was something that they went through to serve their public expectation and the politics of war. No, these were men that and women that, to a person, would convince me anything was better than a war. Anything, anything was better than that, going to war. But soldiers don't start wars. Politicians do, yeah? And I'm not meaning to be insulting to politicians, but take a look. Look through history and look at what's going on in our current climate. Oh, but the current climate is changed because of the level of the increased level of accountability is making it appear like things have just become so explosive and fragmented. Not at all, not at all. We've gone through these periods before in history. We just don't like to think about it. And the risk that we face here is the risk that we face today, and that's imminent. Okay, I've got that. But if ever there's a movement, major powers that are making money off of the military structure are also disguising huge peace movements within their nations, huge active peace movements. You can suppress any mention of them. This is where accountability is, the accountability of all of this ruthlessness is just is so remarkable. Every last sod. Is there anybody on the planet hardly that doesn't have a smartphone? They're going to take a film of what's going on, and within seconds, it's going to be out there on the internet. And who's going to be able to contain it? Well, we see governments that are trying to do that with technology, and it's not working. There's so much leakage, and so everybody gets to see firsthand, and then we're all accountable. Man, we've been dragged back to Athens. Every one of us is a citizen, and yes, I know it was a misogynist, crazy place with constant wars. We're going over and fighting, or somebody's coming over to attack us. But the point I'm trying to make here is that we are individually accountable for ourselves and what we're saying and what we're thinking. We've had what do they call them, incels. Those are startling kinds of young men. We've got all kinds of very fringe people, and the feeling is that we're taking stupidity seriously. But what we're doing is people have power, and like any group of people that are new to it, we don't walk around with that smugness. Oh well, we were born to this. Well, we did away with that. My good, we did away with that, what, in the 19th century or the 20th century, that smugness. They may think it, but they won't say it because we've done away with that. And individual accountability, we're finding you can say harmful things to a young reporter, but we're going to protect your interests. Yep. And you may not like it, but we're going to protect your interests, and we're going to, and you will be held to account. That's the way our systems are. It may take us a while, but inevitably, there is that thought that if we do it, everything's going to go underground, or there is that thought that we will reach that tipping point where it's not worth it anymore, and that we begin to harmonize. Guaranteed basic income is doing that. Universal health care is doing that. And we're finding that there are ways to, that there are whole theories out there, whole frameworks to do away with this hourly wage business, where the world does not collapse into a stupor, where that has happened with some of the ham-fisted experiments that went on, and it's gone on for quite some time. Here we're looking at a fellow that was an anti-war protester. I'm one of them. I honor the people that give their lives. There's no question, no question. And I know that there are knuckleheads that will presume, they'll berate this kind of thinking. but I would rather that I do what I can to put my name forward and resist war, because I don't want so much madness to happen. I don't want people to be murdered. So all of that aside, this is a fellow that died very early. In 1915, he enlisted in the British Army, and he went to experience the trench warfare. He's noted for his anger at the cruelty and waste of war and his pity for its victims. And his work was particularly influential in the 1930s. He was at the University of London, and after illness in 1913, he lived in France, and he had already begun to write and was working as a tutor near Bordeaux, or preparing a small book, you know, minor poems in minor keys. But that was never published. And he was influenced, you know, think you model his early poems on John Keats. Like, gee, there's, okay, that seems quite right. But the poems written after January 1917 were full of anger at war's brutality. I say this because we've just passed Remembrance Day, but it's, I don't know, too much madness going on in the world reminds me. So I was looking for something. When I came across this by accident, it was one of those, it was heavy, it was intense, and I had to stop and rethink. Because his work is, it's not like you're reading somebody saying, you know, here's the bottle of wine, it has notes of, or this scotch has notes of vanilla and caramel and, yeah, okay, and medicinal undertone. No, this is what it is. Awareness and specific emotional response and meaning. His poem, and it's protested, Dulce e decorum est. Yep. It even creates, even the title creates controversy. Dulce e decorum est pro patria mori. It means it is sweet and right to die for your country. Wilford didn't agree. Oh, he died in the war. Yeah. This is taken from, and it's the title's picked up from the old Latin saying how sweet and honorable it is to die for one's country. Listen to this. See what it does to you. Bent double like old beggars under sacks, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the hunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas! See a fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time, but someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or wine. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea we saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering and choking and drowning. If in some smoldering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his hanging face like a devil's sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent with some desperate glory the old lie, dulcia decorum est pro patria mori. All I can say is, damn. Damn war, damn gas, damned. Cool night, eh? Funny, I've been thinking about, you know, those old canards, bromides, you know, if you don't learn from history, you risk repeating it, something to that effect. Here, we're picking this up in Amsterdam. We've witnessed changes happening and a growth of nationalism, and in the background, the spirit of revolution. Now, remember, this period in France, and at this time, England has already beheaded Charles I, and his son has been reinstated. They've gone through Cromwell and that. Learning experience, and Cromwell has been executed, and they're trying to experimenting with some new forms of parliamentary representation, such as it is. And here we're turning our attention to a night with our small lodge that's been around for a long time. And had secretaries that wrote note all is well and everybody's having a good time. You know, the usual mindless, thoughtless kind of an approach. And it starts off here today. In the Masonic Temple, the fantasy of equality. In the Masonic Temple, the fantasy of equality could be given a verbal reality, so actually impossible anywhere else. Just talk about it. The order now routinely refers to the equality of the people. New members are routinely introduced as citizens, and the master, orator, and at least one other member of the lodge were also members of the new revolutionary council that governed in Amsterdam. Rather than imagining that all lodges flourished in this new atmosphere of equality and fraternity, the reverse appears to be true, where some brothers were too busy with the revolution to go to their lodges, or, as we shall see, lodges had become suspect during the terror. So too in the Netherlands, the sociability born in more peaceful times seems to languish in the 1790s. A larger and more pressing civil society was coming into existence and needed tending. National meetings of all the lodges failed to materialize, but in Le Bien-Aimé, elections continued, as did the annual but very secular Christmas festivities. On Christmas Day, the Feast of Saturn was once again celebrated, at which occasion the tyrant Tarquin and his damnable wife Tullio and various of their horrid supporters were chased from Rome, and this was applied to the present circumstance in general, and consequently, in particular, to the origin of our Masonic festival of St. Tyrant Tarquin, for those of you who are scribbling down a reference, and I know you are. The rewriting of Masonic mythology, this time the origin of its major festival, parallels the creation of the Cromwell myth. The Masonic creed, with its deistic tendencies, could encompass just about any human historical experience and render it into the narrative of a new mythology. Interesting for the mythologies and continuities of the early modern European revolutions, the Masonic tendency to create secular myths generally work in favor of tyrannicides or mere tyrant chasers. This lodge of free Batavians continued its identification with rulers right to the last years of this century. The order of Freemasons descends in a straight line from the Lords of the Temple, who organized from the Knights of St. John, so that the celebration of the festival of St. John by the brothers is most praiseworthy and reasonable. There's a hint here that it's not historically that useful, but the myth contains the message. Let's start realizing Masonry validates some very powerful myths. Move over Joseph Campbell, which is wonderful. I hope the show has been useful for you today. Informative. I do. I look forward to sitting in with you next week, and we'll get back to a regular swing. Fingers crossed to my lovely friend, Kip, for giving me feedback on the music. Fingers crossed here again. And I appreciate all of you, the support from all of you. You have no doubt. There can't be a question in your mind. North America has been solid, and Britain has been solidly behind what we're doing here. But Brazil, thank you so much. South Africa, we're so happy to have you sit in with us. And Japan, as ever. And if there's others, Germany or Russia that I'm overlooking, please, I apologize for that. My misdoing. I look forward to being with you again. See you in a week's time. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Creator knows they're needed. And take care of your own happiness.